Okay. After having looked at mutation, permanent, random, unrepaired change to DNA, we need to look now at inheritance. And hopefully, most of you are here because you at least passed something about inheritance. What might have been called Mendelian genetics. So what we want to do is put another, shall we say, put our level of understanding over the top of it and explain it. Because when Gregor Mendel published, well, when Mendel published what was one of the brilliant pieces of science in the world, he published it in a journal that nobody read. And nobody read it probably because he was a monk. He published it in German. That isn't the reason that nobody read it. Because science used to be published in German. I was supposed to do German at university so that I could complete my science degree adequately. And when I was confronted with the only paper I ever had to read in German, I was completely out of my depth. Because it was substituting sulfonamides onto azo group. Yeah, it's just like way, way, way too complicated. So, but he published, and it wasn't discovered for a long time. He also published his work about inheritance at a time when no one knew anything about genes. And there have been some interesting theories about how you inherit characteristics over the years, but very few of them had anything to do with a sort of measurable biological thing, because there were odd stuff. The odd stuff is, I said, shown in my family, how come I can get blonde, blue-eyed children? And also, we get the one about some things appear to get diluted as the generations go down, and then all of a sudden we'll get what might be referred to as a throwback. You'll get red hair appearing when it hasn't been seen in the family for generations. You get other odd things that happen in families, like, without spending too much time talking about my family, because it's not all about me, there's like a body shape in one branch of my family, like my father's family. It's sort of tall and skinny, so I didn't get that one. But my father's family, there's a tall, skinny body type. And my grandfather had it, my uncle has it, my brother has it. So, you know, when my grandfather died, we went up, cleaned up his house, and, you know, going through the wardrobe, we found this tuxedo that had been tailored, had a tailor's mark in it, you know, tailored in 1931 or something like that. My brother thought, oh, this is cool, put it out, put it on, looked like it had been tailored for him. Those sorts of little spooky things. So, DNA gives biologists tools to deal with this. But I suppose it's sensible at this point, sensible at this point to find out what you know about this already. Because this is the stuff about dominant and recessive, homozygous, heterozygous, Punnett squares, what might be called monohybrid inheritance, all that sort of stuff. Okay. Dominant, recessive, Punnett square, phenotype, genotype, homozygous, heterozygous. We'll put the word monohybrid on the end. How many of you could write a definition for all those words? All except the bottom one. Okay? You should be able to deal with all except the bottom one in terms of what you bring to the subject from year 11. So we go past it, and I'm happy to do, at the moment I want to do year 11 type definitions, because we're going to hopefully cast some more light on them next. So, dominant. Josh, what's dominant? Character seen if. That's the character that's seen whether there's one or two copies. The character that's expressed, but I've said seen because again, we're going to start talking DNA some more. Okay, well, in that context then, talk to me about recessive. Yes, you. Okay. So we're on this, this two things are important. We need to remember the onesies and twosies. Okay. Punnett square, Johnny. Okay, what's it for? Okay, so it's a, yeah, it's actually a probability predictor. And these days, in the unlikely event that I get to teach Year 11, we refer to it as Professor Punnett's probability predictor. So yeah, predicting the likely outcomes of a cross. Right, phenotype. Sorry? Appearance. Okay. What it looks like, and if we learn phonetically, phenotype and face. So, phenotype's the appearance. What's the genotype? It. What it's made of. Okay. Aluminium. What the genes, what there, the actual genes that are present. Oh, there's another word just turned up. Okay, one of these words with too many vowels. Well, and not enough consonants either. Right, homozygous. Okay, homo, same, so two genes the same. We're going to start using this word in sentences very shortly. Hetero. So if homo means same, hetero means different. Right. Now, monohybrid you won't necessarily have come across, but how many things are we talking about in a mono thing? Just one. So it's one characteristic. It's a cross involving only one characteristic. Okay, so what's an allele? Sharp. Can we summarise it into like a small phrase? I heard the word. Starts with V. Version. Yeah. All that's true. The different things you see, what the different genes make. Allele here is the different versions of a gene. Hair colour 2.0, hair colour 2.1. Bugs got out of it. Okay, so on that little list, dominant, recessive, Punnett square, phenotype, genotype, homozygous, heterozygous, monohybrid, how many places have we used the word gene where the word allele would actually be more accurate? Okay, certainly homo and heterozygous. And where I've written character seen if only one present, you could probably write allele after the number as well. So, let's... Allele's an awkward word. Doesn't roll well off the tongue. Philologists must hate it. It's a word that Tolkien would probably never have used in his writings, because he was interested in the way words sound and the way they work and where they come from. All right. Now, we're going to add to the definition of allele. Different version of a gene. What would make two versions of a gene different? Okay, let's back it up a step. What are genes made of? Someone in the back row. Genes are made of DNA. Okay, so the information on them is the order of the letters. Okay, and what do we need to know whenever we're discussing things in genetics? Little phrase that I want to see written on any of your exams and tests. DNA makes RNA, which makes protein, which is what the trait or the characteristic is. So in that case, I haven't written that proteins make stuff, or DNA. So at its most simple, that central dogma of molecular biology is even more abbreviated. DNA makes stuff. So whenever you're thinking about genetics, you've got to be asking, what got made here? Where did the code to make it come from? The code is the DNA. So if you get a change in stuff, no matter what it is, means there was a code in that. The underlying code's always the DNA. So we've got to stick with that all the time. Okay. We might try a couple of alleles for interest. Because we've talked about the sorts of things that we look at in the junior school. You know, do you have a widow's peak? Can you give a hitchhiker's thumb? Can you roll your tongue? How many people can roll their tongues? Okay. And we've got a wonderful proportion of left-handers, so that's a good thing. There are a whole bunch when we start looking at it. Back when I was at school, after we'd dodged the saber-toothed cats on our way to school and fought off a dinosaur to get through the school gate, our teachers could use us as experimental animals, and that was sort of okay. It's become un-okay. But the best one of these that I have ever seen for genetic variation is called the ability to taste phenylthiocarbamide. Biologists love to abbreviate, and chemists always create long words. It's called PTC. Phenylthiocarbamide, also closely related thing called phenylthiouria. But as a piece of theatre, the ability to taste that or not is genetically inherited. There's the rest of the story. But anyway, teacher took us in, you know, lined all 40 of us up down the side of the classroom, and said, right, I'm going to give you each a piece of paper, hold it in your hand till I tell you what to do with it, and a little piece of like litmus paper, only colourless. Gave us each a piece and said, okay, on three, I want you to put it in your mouth and chew it. Okay? Line of 40 of us, all boys, lined up and go one, two, three, and two-thirds of people, they went, pah! Yeah! Really, really bitter. And the other third were sitting there chewing the piece of paper, trying to work out what on earth was going on, because that tasted like wet paper to them. We're not allowed to use that anymore, which is really sad, because that kind of theatre is... Like, I haven't forgotten it, and it was like zillions of years ago. The poor guy who discovered this, apparently, according to my favourite geneticist, was completely bamboozled by it, just like my classmates who were trying really hard to work out what on earth was going on beside them. Because he, after World War II in the United States, decided that he'd use some of this newly created industrial capacity to make plastic. And, because this is America, what do you make from plastic that everybody needs and everybody's going to buy in the coming 1950s in the boom? Ice cube trays. So he made plastic ice cube. I've got one. Not one of his, but plastic ice cube trays. Okay, every American home should have one. Well, actually probably every American home should have 15 of them, because every New Zealand home's got at least three or four. So, he made these. They were beautiful. They had ice cubes well. The ice cubes came out of them. All of it worked beautifully. But people kept sending the odd one back, saying, the ice tastes nasty. So he'd take the tray, fill it with water, put it in the freezer, get the ice cubes and chew his way through them. Ice tastes fine. Give it to other people around. Ice tastes fine. Write back to the people saying, look, I'm really sorry, I do not understand. The ice tastes fine when I make them. Here, have a new ice cube tray. And they'd send it back going, no, the ice still tastes dreadful. Eventually, they found out it was this genetic thing, that the ability to taste phenylthiocarbamide is inherited in a Mendelian fashion. There are at least two versions of the gene. One where you can taste it and one where you can't. Now, all of those things, that one accepted actually, appear to have no particular survival value, unless you're being picked on because of your hairline or because of your hair colour. Because of your hair colour or what hand you write with, and we're not picked on for what hand we write with anymore. The oppressors just make plastic hands and scissors. So, most of the things, like, or whether hair grows on the second knuckle of your finger or whether your second toe is longer than your big toe, you might be oppressed by shoe manufacturers, but you're not oppressed by anybody else. But it goes much, much deeper. Much, much, much deeper. We've had a few stories. Okay. So, what are alleles? They must be made of DNA. I'll get you to use it for something useful then, shall we? Write this. Okay, and I like developing these things from the very beginning, so we said two different versions of a gene. Okay, so they must be made of now. We revise that. DNA is made of nucleotides. And nucleotides are made of three bits. Sugar, phosphate, and base. Two of those three things are not useful for this sort of discussion. What are they? Sugar and phosphate, the backbone of the DNA. So it's in the bases. Okay, so DNA information is order of the bases, the base sequence. And if you change it, what does DNA make? Ooh. Got this thing back again. So, if it's the order of the bases, the base sequence, what does DNA make? DNA makes? Which makes? So, if what we see is different, like our ability to taste PTC, a protein must be different, so the RNA must have been different, so the DNA must have been different. How different is a really, really interesting question. How different do you have to make it before you notice it? Scary answer to that question. So, two alleles have okay, how different? This might be. So, on that thing of the fight to be male, we have the difference between normal male and people who grow up as girls and turn into boys at puberty, one DNA base. It's one DNA base in one protein that catalyzes the conversion of testosterone to dihydrotestosterone. And so at puberty, there's enough testosterone in the system that some of it gets made into dihydrotestosterone, and the body goes, oh, male. It's very uncommon. It's very uncommon. We're going to get to unpack some more about like how you can get that sort of inheritance. It's actually probably you shouldn't try and have children with anyone you're related to. In this case, the personal history is that this is the Dominican Republic. It's a small Caribbean island. And then one woman got the mutation, so the two alleles became different in her. She had four husbands and 27 children. That made a big difference to the island. And then, well, the whole point is that in a small place, while any kind of contact between brothers and sisters is frowned upon, you don't necessarily know who your cousins are or get that choice. And cousins share a grandparent. Yeah. Now, in our society, there are ways of suggesting that you tend to look away from your family. There are a whole lot of subliminal cues that seem to direct us in that fashion, which is about stuff like smell. There's at least two studies. One of them is that guys seem to prefer the smell of women. Now, long study, but they got girls to go to bed in clean T-shirt. At the end of the week, they take the T-shirt, put it in a jar, and guys would do a sniff test and like just rank the jars in terms of which one smelt best to which one smelt worst. And the one that smelt best was the girl who was most genetically different from him, and the one that he liked the least smelt was the girl who smelt most similar. They've done a converse study where they found that girls tend to be attracted to men who smell least like their fathers, which is the same thing. Exactly. We don't want to think about the rest of the implications of that statement, but it's the thing about trying to keep us as genetically diverse as possible. Humans are really, really inbred. Humans are very, very genetically similar. So we've got these things in our biology that try and push us away. Anyway, it seems, yeah. If you can't do that, then, you know, inbred has been reasonably okay. Cleopatra, you know, famous, you know, Antony and Cleopatra fame, had children with Julius Caesar, that kind of thing, was apparently relatively attractive. She managed to convince a whole lot of men that she was anyway. Her aunt, they did a test, her aunt apparently had identical copies of at least two-thirds of her chromosomes, which means that like two-thirds of her ancestors were the same person. Because Egyptian royalty, you know, royalty don't breed with commoners, so that royalty are gods. So it's a little bit more intense than the royal family now, because it went on for generation after generation. And they got that lovely Greek word called Philadelphia. I know it's the name of the city in the United States, but what does it mean what's the translation from the Greek? Brother lover. So Philadelphia in the United States is referred to as the city of brotherly love in a very platonic fashion. Well, no, because Plato was Greek, and that's sort of the wrong place to go with that conversation as well. But this whole thing here is two alleles differ by one DNA base. Now, that's true for a whole lot of things. And if you end up with two recessive copies, the first things that we identify are all really, really serious. Okay, I'm going to read you one more story, then we're going to talk about it. So, this is from one of the most wonderful books that I got as a for a Christmas present. So, New Yorker Sandy Gordon knew something was amiss. It started with whispers and comments at work. Co-workers began stopping near her desk and saying, "What's that smell? Who needs a shower?" Yeah, I could, but I like reading, so. Then there was a foul odour in her apartment that she got the building super to try and fix the plumbing. Find it still stank when the repairs were done. Her nieces and nephews said, "Aunt Sandy, you didn't brush today, your breath stinks." She thought it was something she'd eaten. The awful truth came when a friend and co-worker suggested that they have lunch together one day. And instead of a quick bite to catch up on things, her friend told her that she was the source of the odour, so foul and fishy that it was disrupting the workplace. And she was devastated. She started crying right in the restaurant. So, took a 3-month leave of absence, tried to fix it, found out in the end that she'd inherited 2 copies of a gene that infected her protein metabolism, and she ended up smelling of fish. The book's called... It's given a name. It's called trimethylaminuria. Okay, wonderful thing. Her co-workers complained, and the boss said, well, when you work as hard as she does, you can complain. Otherwise, until then, go away. So, there's a particular thing. There's a biochemical cause, and again, it's a single base change mutation. And now we'll show... show Johnny the cover. Okay? Best book. Right. One of the best books I read. So it's called When a Gene Makes You Smell Like a Fish. Oops, not that one. That one. So, when a gene makes you smell like a fish, tales about your genes and stuff about your body. There's a bunch of genes where if you get 2 copies of them, you end up with genetic condition. Like this, like little girls turning into boys. Okay, the answer to how different, 1 base. Now, I'm going to follow the very last thing, and I'm actually going to show you a PowerPoint slide that I'm using for year 13. Not because I don't think you're up to it, but there is a relevance thing. So, 2 alleles have different DNA sequences. To see one of these changes, it can be as different as a single base. And we can put the single base change, that's the little girls turning into boys. That is... this one, trimethylaminuria, it's also, what am I looking for, PowerPoint, okay, it's also stuff that happens in your blood. Now, for those of you who talked about, someone talked about the current British royal family and the effect of what was probably a mutation in Queen Victoria's father. Queen Victoria's father was an older gentleman when she was conceived, and paternal age is also a contributor with some mutation. So, you see this slide ends up saying, oh, DNA makes RNA, which makes protein. And we're just having a wee look. Okay, you change a single base, you change the order of amino acids. The question about what happens, actually, I'll try and speed through it. I'll do some speed. Okay, it's a DNA sequence. You can see that DNA sequences are very dull. There's a picture of what's called sickle cell anemia. 2 forms of hemoglobin, and this is normal. Normal one forms the nice donut-shaped red blood cells. If you get the sickle cell one, under oxygen stress, your blood cells change shape. Because your capillaries are designed to work with nice circular bendy red blood cells, these ones don't work so well. Okay, there's a picture of them in the reel. Quite pointy. And what happens is they tend to clog in the capillary beds. This here, so the bottom picture, is this is not working well. So capillaries, if you've ever seen pictures of them, the blood cells come cruising around and they squeeze through the capillary and they squeeze around there. This one, the sickled cells get jammed and you end up getting a whole bunch of things go wrong. Okay. It's a single base mutation. It's an A turned into a T. Now in this case it does change the amino acid. And if you see what happens with the amino acid, it has really, really significant effects. Like that. Single base change. So, where we needed to get to with this, two alleles have different DNA sequence. They can differ by one or a whole lot more than one base, depending on what's actually being made. So one base. Now, we've also talked briefly about dominant and recessive in terms of DNA. What makes something dominant? I beg your pardon. We also talked about mutations being recessive. What makes mutations recessive? Usually, because the gene product is broken. If you were born with, I mean, sickle cell, for example, is a really, really bad thing. If the whole population had sickle cell, it probably wouldn't survive. Even though people can actually live reasonable life like this, and there's also the downstream things about genetic profiling that goes with this, racial profiling. So, one or more. But mutations are usually recessive because the protein's broken or not as functional. So, okay, we're going to use another big word at the moment. I'll translate. Okay. Mutations are usually recessive and deleterious. Bad. Because okay, so use the example of sickle cell. The example of sickle cell is that most people don't get it. If you get sickle cell, you've got that allele, which when you've got two of them, causes your blood cells to cause the sickle. Hemoglobin precipitates changes the blood cell shape, and we'll say the health effects of sickle cell are deleterious also. Okay. So if we're going back through alleles, we're going to go back through the inheritance of them, and just model it, hopefully in a relatively simple fashion. So, Mendel, doing his thing, started with peas. So, Mendel's papers are available online because they're, so the last time I read it, 27 pages, they've been translated from German. You can either read them in German or read them in English. and worked with peas. Does anyone know where he worked? He published in German, so of course he worked in the Czech Republic. Published in German, yeah. He was often referred to as a Moravian monk in the town that hasn't got enough vowels in it. And I think in Czech it's got even fewer vowels than that. So, the town that I'd refer to as Brno. I know that because they had a round of the European touring car racing series there. Now, flower colour in peas. There are two flower colours in peas. Purple. Now, if you had a mutation in the gene for making flower colour, what might you get? Sorry? White. If you break the gene, doesn't work, it doesn't make colour. The chances of you getting something that makes a different colour are probably low. Purple and white. So the purple is because purple stuff got made. And white, no purple. So it's likely that white's the result of a mutation. The colour in these, sorry? Yeah, it's most likely in this case that purple's, yeah, where the colour came from might have changes in genes. But if we're looking at this kind of thing, mostly purple's there because purple colour got made. White, purple colour didn't get made, so the thing's uncoloured. That goes back to why are flowers coloured, why do plants invest in making their flowers coloured? And it's usually to attract whatever pollinator they want. So they're investing in attracting a pollinator, and they're investing, like, why do plants make nectar? And why do plants make nectar? So the bees can make honey? They're bribing the bees to come. It's got no benefit apart from the fact that obviously the plants that do, the bees go, they stay around to collect nectar, get pollen on themselves, and then go to another one that's also got nectar, which the plant hopes is the same species. So if it keeps on doing the bribe thing, the plants will get pollinated. Okay, so if there's genes for purple, we'll go through this because hopefully you know the Punnett square thing. Genotypes of the parents. Now, P is a really bad choice for the allele symbol. It's called the P1 generation. So it's often useful if you're doing it to pick letters that have different upper and lowercase shapes is the best option, or make them look different. Don't pick O. Okay, P's not a great choice either. B's, D's, Y's a bad choice. Not as bad as O, but it's pretty bad, especially if you're writing them fast. Was that a big one or a little one? So if you're doing Y's, for example, you can do one with lines and one with round. That works. But, yeah, the symbol you use doesn't matter. What's the process that these peas, containing the P alleles, use to make baby peas? So, that's the parent generation. Meiosis happens, and we separate the alleles. So that's separated. Meiosis separates pairs of chromosomes into single things. They make gametes. So meiosis makes gametes. Hopefully none of you are seeing this for the first time. Okay. Now, the risk of annoying people, I'm going to do my Punnett square on its edge. So big P's down one side, little P's down the other. What happens in the middle? You make babies. And from that cross, pure breeding purple against pure breeding white, all of the offspring are heterozygous. And it's traditional, it's a good idea to write down the genotypes and the phenotypes. Four of them are purple. Next step, this is one of the reasons that they often use plants for this. The next step, so this is called the F1, the first filial generation. And we get, and we can do this in peas, they are, the word is, selfed. Because we don't want to use any of the other words for inbreeding that might suggest that there are human connections with it. And you can finish that from there, can't you? Two heterozygous gametes. Punnett square. Big P and little p. We get one homozygous dominant, two heterozygous, and one homozygous recessive. So one homozygous dominant, two heterozygotes, which are also purple, and one homozygous recessive. Right. I'm expecting you can all do this. Make it... If you can't, the suggestion here is make it so. Check in your book. If you need to have a look at stuff that you did in year 11, do so. Because this is going to be something that we assume you can do.